I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business.
Hey, gang,
oh, or little here
to
buy some fish, or you want to look at wine, beer, still.
No, we're not purchasing that. What's next up today?
Rock, Lincoln.
Wine, 10%. Thanks. Bill Fitch on the show today of Hillside and also Vinegar Hill House in Brooklyn. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello. I'm fine, thank you.
How are you now?
Now even better.
So buddy, you weren't so into the wine originally, but you were doing some other stuff, and you know what kind of happened along the way.
Yeah, I didn't really. There wasn't in the, I would say the mid to late '80s. The whole idea of a sommelier was something that was that happened somewhere else. It was far away. It wasn't really an option, at least to me. In Oregon, but I got into it through perfume. I was really into olfaction because I hadn't been able to smell for a little while, for maybe a year and a half, who knows.
And what was that about? What was the not smelling about? How did that happen?
I had broken my nose a lot. It was Oregon, lots of mold in Oregon. I'm not sure, but I had a cluster of polyps. Disgustingly in my sinuses, and I just hadn't noticed that I couldn't smell. But when I couldn't breathe, I had to go to the hospital, and after surgery, the doctor told me that I hadn't probably been able to smell for a while, and I got really into perfume after that. I remember the first thing I could smell after the antibiotics and the painkillers wore off. It was mulligatawny soup. But anyway, I got into perfume. And I used to spend way too much money on women's perfume and spray my pillow at night. And obsessing about the ingredients, the stories behind the perfumes. And basically a friend sort of took pity on me and told me that wine was also olfactory. And he worked in this place that was kind of legendary in Portland called the Vat and Tonsure. And he got me a job there. Very soon thereafter, I can't remember exactly, but so I got super into wine there, not really systematically, but they had about 1,000 European wines and about 10 or so Oregon wines, and that was it. So I tasted a lot, read a lot, got sort of obsessed with, I don't know, the idea of a sommelier. Or just sort of some an aesthetic expert at the time. I read tons of books about it.
Because I remember when we first met, you were telling me about that Luca Turin book about the Emperor Scent.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that I encountered a bit later, once I got to New York. But, like, you know, there were, like, in Imperial China, there were experts about, experts on cricket songs. And there were experts about, like, the putrefaction, the beauties of putrefying bound feet. And it kind of was very interesting to me. And not that wine is, like, putrefying bound feet, but kind of. And, I didn't really get a systematic knowledge in Oregon about, you know, like I sort of did later. But I just kind of jumped into it as a hobby, sort of. And I worked with it a bit.
But you're also doing some traveling.
Yeah, I traveled a lot. I had this family of Bosnian refugees that I was sort of supporting and were living in my house.
How did that happen?
How did it happen? I met this a brother and sister in Paris after I'd been traveling a lot. And I learned all about what was going on in the former Yugoslavia.
This was during a period of time when there was a lot of people being killed there.
Oh, yeah. It was about 93, 94, 93. And I'd been sort of traveling for almost 18 months. Bikes, bicycle travels, all kinds of silly, you know, not very morally demanding activities. And I just felt really... it happened for a lot of people from my generation. The Bosnia thing sort of I guess, inspired, made a lot of people sort of commit to doing stuff. A lot of journalists I know, that's where they started. But anyway, so I thought I should try to do something. And in the end, I had to marry this girl, one of the people I met, because their whole family was going to get sent back to Bosnia. The father was still there in Sarajevo. And so I thought maybe I could get her some kind of translating, some kind of work visa where she could then invite her family. But I couldn't, so I married her. And they all came to live with me little by little and drove me absolutely nuts. I love them terribly, but it was absolutely crazy. But anyway, during that time, I was doing all kinds of jobs to support them. I was working with a lot of other refugees, bringing refugees with a group, a nonprofit group that started to bring refugees to Portland.
How many people did you bring over?
Well, altogether, 2,500, because there was a larger organization that worked with Vietnamese refugees that had started during the Vietnam War. And first we went to them to ask them what we should do and how we could do this. And they're like, they'll get grant money if there's a population of 2,500. So we kind of were working towards that over, I don't know, a couple of years. And many more people joined. We started the Club of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which was basically this, we rented this little space with a pool table, and they loved it. Like, we thought how hideous, but they would come all the time and talk, play pool, drink, cook, you know, their specialties.
The alternative would be to stay in their own country and get shot at by snipers.
Or like stay in their little apartments and that we found all over Portland. But it was like a little social group that they... Anyway, I was into that for a long time, and that's when I started working at this place, the Vat and Tonsure, or actually where I started working at it the second time. But yeah, I didn't... It's not like I expected I would ever work in wine. I was just... I was dreaming about traveling more and finally getting these people settled and then get the fuck out, and which I did finally.
You were able to kind of separate yourself from the movement a little bit and get out of town.
Yeah, you know, the war ended. Basically, the war... Yeah, basically around the time when it was over, and my own particular family was self-sufficient, I went to Mexico, I went to Madagascar, I actually went to Sarajevo, and then I came back to New York needing work, still paying rent for them in Portland, so I needed quick work.
Some money, yeah.
And so I got a job at Il Buco. They needed a wine waiter. You know, they didn't say sommelier. It wasn't really, you know, there was like, what, Roger de Gorm. There were, maybe, I'm sure there were, but I didn't know of them. And it wasn't like there's a gazillion of them like now. So they just hired me just from talking. You know, I knew enough about wine to help customers pick wine on their list. And then right around that time, a few months after, this is like 98, American Sommelier Association was starting their first certification courses. And I don't know if I was in the first year or the second year. I think maybe the second year. So Il Buco basically paid for me to do that. And that was the sort of systematic knowledge that I got. I mean, light, but at least I had a, you know, sort of an umbrella about, you know, of knowledge or of information about the world's wines.
What was Il Buco like at that time, 98?
It's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
It was so awesome that I'm still sort of a part of their whole, I don't know, dysfunctional family. I go there all the time. But it was, I would say it was very, very, very much a party scene. An ex-girlfriend of mine had been one of their first servers. And she's the one that told me they needed a wine person. And I remember it when it first opened in like 94, 95, something like that. And it really was like a party, an antique shop with not much capacity to serve people. But it was super fun, in like old East Village-y kind of way. But by 98, it was becoming more of a restaurant. It was a restaurant, and they got a real bar. But I just learned a lot. I don't know, it was just raw, you know, and going to every table talking about wine, like, you know, being a sommelier.
Nossiter had been there.
Oh, yeah, Nossiter was the... I guess he did the first wine list. And, in fact, we even found, like, they're the bowels of Il Buco are vast. And we found some of the wines that I think he had put on, or at least was thinking of putting on, like, some strange Romanian wines. And I remember one of the labels of the Romanian bottle said, the greatest wine in the world. It was awesome. But, yeah, he'd been there. He came, he came in a lot, actually. And,
what was he like? Because I've never met him.
He and I sort of got along because we both studied classics.
Okay.
In school, so. But he was, you know, smart, kind of, you know, into the pleasures of wine. And, I, you know, in my mind, he's kind of one of the first, I don't know, wine consultants. I don't know if that's true, but, like, I know he did, like, a few wine lists without actually being a sommelier in them. I mean, I didn't know him that well, just from serving him, and then we'd go out sometimes afterwards. But
And Roberto Paris was around?
Roberto came just a bit before me, we're blood brothers.
Is that true?
No, we're not blood brothers.
But you're close.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we're...
You haven't actually slashed open a finger?
Psychotic, fraternal, I don't know, freak brothers. But, and Alfredo was there. He's back now. You know, Alfredo Ruiz, who worked for, he worked for Babbo, he worked for Del Posto. Now he's back at the Alimentari. So it's kind of, I like to go there because it's like my old family.
I had a really good meal there not too long ago.
Me too. It's insanely good food. But, yeah, so Roberto... Roberto was sort of the manager, the sort of the head of the wine program to a degree. I can't remember how, maybe Alfredo was, I don't know. But anyway, Savio Suarez was there. At one point he became a manager. So different people were sort of the overseers of the wine program.
What was Savio like back then?
He was all gung-ho. He had all kinds of things. bought a lot of wine, changed the wine list a bit, if I remember correctly. More Austrian stuff, you know, stuff that he was into then. But he was, you know, he's a very interesting character, cool personality. finally, I don't know how he left. He went back to Europe or something. I can't remember.
You actually moved more in that Nasser direction of doing some more consulting yourself.
Yeah, I had some friends who, once I was certified, I had some friends who were opening a place called Stella, which was kind of awesome, but it was all new world, which was somewhat of a challenge.
Challenge for you, because you'd come from mostly European.
Kind of. I mean, it was a challenge just because aesthetically or whatever, like one would think that, you know, geeks like European wines more, although then it was a little different. But it was a fun list, I thought, and the place was great. And it kind of died with 9/11 because it was on McDougal, south of Houston, and that really, I don't know if you remember, but like changed everything, and especially south of Houston. So we were slamming, packed. And then boom, nothing. But then also the park, that place is still there, 10th and 17th Street. They asked me to do their wine list, which was fun. Basically, I got several different consulting gigs just to make the wine list, be the wine buyer as a consultant, which was great. I could just wear jeans, just ride my bike around, taste wines. It didn't suck. And after a few years, I was able to even get off the floor at Il Buco, which was also kind of great. But then in 2004, my wife got transferred to Paris, and we moved to Paris. And
she was working in the magazine business.
Yeah, she was an editor at W Magazine. But I wasn't allowed to work, so...
Because you weren't a Paris, you weren't a French citizen.
Yeah, and nor was she. So she had a journalist visa, and as her husband, I was able to live there, but not to work for a French company or whatever.
Sounds like a real bad deal. Being stuck in Paris and not having to work.
I was pounding the floor every day. Yeah, like, miserable.
I have to go hang out in the cafe again.
It was the suckiest situation ever. No. Yeah, that was awesome. So I thought, okay, well, that's the end of that. I mean, no more wine, really. I mean, in terms of career, because
right,
we had
right.
other plans, you know. And so I was still into it, but aesthetically, you know, I'm really into. I like to read about dorky issues about wine. Like, I think it's everybody likes to talk about wine, but not, in my opinion, not really about, you know, like aesthetics, and they don't give a lot of you know, there's not a lot of deep discussion about what you think beautiful is or why you think this wine is better than another. Like, it's sort of a lot of empty I don't know,
surface
verbiage, kind of, a lot, which is fun in its own way, of course, but I kind of am, I olfaction is not a, it's the last sense that we don't know anything about, and it's very interesting to talk about, you know, the subjective content of our evaluations. And I think it's it would be nice to see more, you know, of quasi philosophical, if not philosophical, or at least, you know, whatever, that kind of, you know, talk. So I read a lot about that when I was in Paris. I got really into that, just as a hobby, and also with perfume too, and a little bit of foot binding and that sort of thing.
Are you serious with the foot binding? Really? You got into studying it, or you actually
yeah.
did it?
Oh, oh, God, no.
Okay.
It's a horrible, cruel thing.
I wasn't sure what you were saying there.
No, I just like the, you know, well, actually, I have a friend whose stepfather writes a lot about the putrefaction, the beauties of putrefaction, like cheeses and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, well, like Nebbiolo, too, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
All kinds of stuff like that. Yeah. Like, and so that was, there were these freaky Chinese dudes that like pontificated about the beauties of a putrefied female foot. Like, that's just
yeah.
hideous.
Yeah.
But also amazing.
You yeah. know?
Like, and on, you know, like wabi sabi.
No, I don't know what that is.
Wabi sabi is like this sort of Japanese aesthetic concept that's sort of part of their tradition of poetry and tea ceremony, that sort of thing. And it's basically about, the basic principle is that everything comes from nothing and is going to nothing. And it's about like the beauties of sort of decayed things or unfinished things, unrefined things, you know, like statues that have been messed up somehow, or like pottery that with glaze imperfections, or it's the beauty of the imperfect, and even the beauty that can be coaxed out of ugliness. That sort of thing I got into.
I often, and this is true, uh-huh. I often really see that as the difference between Nebbiolo geeks and Burgundy geeks,
uh-huh.
because Burgundy, they seem to really want it to be perfect,
pure, and
yeah, the pure fruit is a big
elegant,
thing,
fine,
and with Nebbiolo. Uh-huh. There's something about it that they don't like that's actually the rustic. Is uh-huh. how we kind of describe it.
Yeah, rustic is wabi-sabi is rusticity.
You know
it's
what I mean?
It's meanings. Yeah.
But the people who like Nebbiolo uh-huh. are looking for that rusticity. Uh-huh. So that's why, even though people are like, Barolo's so Burgundian, I think that's a big... It's uh-huh. it's actually an aesthetic problem,
uh-huh.
the why you don't see more of one into being into the other in reality.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I see it as a big difference between, well, one of the appeals of natural wine. Like, I feel like there's a lot of the aesthetic of natural wine is, or a lot of the appeal of natural wine is approachable or whatever, you can access it through that sort of aesthetic.
That makes a ton of sense to me.
You know, like it's, and obviously, I mean, not obviously, I guess, but to me, there's often excesses with that style, you know, it can be rank. I hate mouse fur, frankly. and that happens a lot.
Because people say mousy sometimes with certain natural wines. And...
Yeah, I believe that it's like one of the 11 manifestations of Brett. But
oh, is that true? Okay, I didn't know that. I mean, that would make sense.
I read that, and it makes sense.
I thought you were going to say of like the Buddha, though. I thought you were going in
that
direction.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, wouldn't that be funny?
No, that would not really. No, that'd be scary. But probably it is though. No. So yeah, I mean, some of the and it's simple. Like also like punk rock and grunge are wabi sabi. Like,
right.
Simple raw rustic.
Natural wine is very punk rock.
I feel like
that's
kind of
like the same thing. You know, like 10 Bells and CBGB, that's the same thing. You know what I mean? For me, at least.
Wow. And it's true. Yeah. There's a rankness about both of them. Huh. Yeah.
And socially, too. Like how they're styled out socially.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, Greasers and Socias and stuff. Like, there's a very punk rock aesthetic, too.
Dude, I think that's that's like a universal thing. Like, I feel like they're...
I do, too. I think it can cut across all kinds of... Like, social and cultural manifestations, and wine is just, we have that for that. You know what I mean?
There's like classicism and romanticism, and it seems like there's...
Exactly.
It's a frequency that just sort of...
It's like Delacroix and Ong, or...
Delacroix and Ong.
All over again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, I think. But so, yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Well, you're in Paris chilling.
Oh, yeah. I'm in Charis pilling. And, I'm in Paris chilling. And and then my wife leaves me, and
does she do like Hare Krishna or something like that?
Hare Krishna, no, she went to India.
Oh, she went to India.
Yeah,
okay.
She actually left. She left her job. She you know, it was a big life change for her, and I was very proud of her and also crushed. But there I was in Paris all alone again. Oh, unbelievably miserable situation, and I started going out a little bit more. Which it was a much more domestic situation before.
Because you were single now, so
yeah, single,
let's get out of the house.
Instead of drowning in my own tears, I better go out. And I started to go out, and that's, you know, it was like the natural wine in Paris was just like, boom.
And did you walk right into it, or what happened?
I had been into it in some places, but then my friend Jorge, who now works at 10 Bells, who had been a manager at the park when I did their wine list, whom I love dearly, came to Paris and was like, dude. I was like, yeah, I think Paris sucks compared to New York.
Is that what you said?
Yeah, and I felt it. And because I just hadn't, I kind of got to know where to go.
Right, because you'd been domesticized.
And I'd been there a while, and, you know.
You're like, there's nothing to do
cooked.
Here.
My wife loved to cook, and she's vegetarian, and, you know, that was our life. So I started to go out and learn like all these amazing places, like Le Vervolet, Le Baratin, a whole bunch of great places.
So you're saying Jorge?
Jorge basically was my Virgil.
Got it.
He came. He was like, "Get hip, dude! I can't believe you don't know this." And then I got really into it. And
what was that scene like?
Just fun.
Yeah.
Like, you'd go to the Vervolet and Cyril was there. This guy Nicolas, who's now in South America, but it was both, now they have an actual kitchen. Before they had a double decker toaster oven, but they were so beloved by, I think they probably still are, by all like farmers and everybody in the food world and wine world, that they had the best ingredients, like unbelievably good, like lettuce from this one little field in Normandy, like it was like succulents and like little ferns and who knows, it was just crazy. And then if you were there late enough, sometimes on a Wednesday or Thursday at like 1, the oyster guy from Utah Beach would arrive, and like you'd just have like the freshest oysters, and you know, endless open bottles opening. It was just, you know, a kind of conviviality, and it was fun talking with all of the dudes who were so into it, like so into natural wine. And I, you know, I still didn't think I was going to have to make a career of it. So I was like, I was into it. It wasn't. I had other ideas, and then
you were more into it to hang out, not so much. You're like, I'm gonna get into this to make this my career.
I mean, that's what I was. Yeah, I was hanging out and, you know, recovering from my divorce or whatever it was at that time, reading a lot, running around. I had enough money, basically, that I was sort of floating for a while. And then 2008 or 9, the stock market, I had boom. And then I had to come back and get into it.
Because you had to make some more money. Like, you were like, oh, wow.
Seems to be the pattern. Yeah.
But, I mean, did you find that they were kind of welcoming to you as in that natural wine set? They were
In Paris, yeah. I mean, I had a bunch of friends in it. I visited a ton of winemakers and would hang out with some of them. And sometimes I found them to be quite awful, frankly. I mean,
yeah.
Because they sometimes can be.
Well, I mean, what I've found is that whole thing where you're like, this group has more angelic people in it, uh-huh. that can be a very road to either surprise or delusion. Like, because, you know, just because they're one style or another doesn't mean they're better people. Oh, you know what I mean? I've found.
In terms of their, you mean their aesthetic decisions don't reflect on their ethical
right morality or just
state, yeah,
like, and some of the same things that you see going on like a what you might call the conventional side, uh-huh. where you're like, that's really dickish behavior, then you see it on the same way on I'm actually talking about more like the consumer side on the natural wine side too. You're like, oh, okay, you're bragging about drinking that super rare Muscadet, because on the other side they're bragging about drinking that super rare Burgundy. But that's actually the same thing.
Oh, exactly.
You know what I mean? It doesn't mean you're less of a dick just because you're
exactly. Yeah, the emperor's new clothes applies in every...
You know what I'm saying?
To match. Yes, I do. Yeah. And I think that's, you know... I don't think... That's normal.
Yeah, it's not going to go away.
It's not just wine.
Anything,
it's like
right.
the art world. Any aesthetic field, basically, has the emperor's new clothes sort of underwritten into it, I think. You know what I mean? Like, it's... I mean, do you know what I mean by emperor's new clothes?
I do. I was actually one of the seamstresses. This is true. I played it in drag in elementary school. I think it was fifth grade. Could have been. Nah, it must have been earlier than that. Must have been like second grade.
Dude, I want pictures.
Red wig, very Tootsie style, long dress. And I was the alternate because I showed up for theater class and they're like, what the hell are you doing here? And I was like, no, this sounds like cool. Like, I'd love to be in a play. You guys are doing a play? Cool. And they're like, yeah, we'll put you in, but we're going to put you in as an alternate. So you can practice with us, and you can read lines, and you can know the part, but probably you're not going to play.
Uh-huh.
And so it was like there was a few performances, and I was in the second one, and I actually scooped it. Like, I think, as I recall, it was a big hit.
Uh-huh.
And
were you tall then, too?
Yeah, for that age, yeah. And it was, I played it in drag. Yeah, it was only a few lines, though. Like, I came on and, like...
You stole the show with your few lines?
I was one of the seamstresses who put on the no clothes.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? So like, you look great in no clothes. Uh-huh. You know, that thing.
Ah, that's good.
It's actually been my whole life.
Exactly. I was gonna
subsequently.
Say,
yeah, without the wig.
You've gone on to bigger and better things.
It's pretty much... Yeah, without the sequins and the wig, it's pretty much been the whole same deal. Since then.
Yeah, isn't it funny, this what we do? Anyway, yeah. So yeah, natural wines, they have their excesses and whatever, I don't know. So anyway, I came back to New York.
But you met some other people too. I mean, who would you go see? What winemakers did you see at that time, and what sellers were you like, interesting to me?
I remember Rene Moss was a big thing for
me. He seems like a ringleader, although it's hard to see over here.
Yeah. Well, it is true, there are ringleaders, aren't there? Like Thierry Puzelat. I'd see him at all the tastings. I never went to see him out in the field. But Rene Moss, Hervé Villemard, whose cousin was my roommate in Paris for a while. I don't know, the Breton, whatever they are, a couple-ish.
Right. Well, that's a whole other podcast.
I don't know.
Ish.
Just... I mean, a bunch of them.
Yeah, but they're not all ish, though. Yeah, some of them.
Yeah, some of them are actually
married and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
God. I palled around a little bit with I don't know if you know Isor de Pombriand.
No, who's that?
She's Domaine de Clozel.
Oh, okay. Savignon. I do know her. Yeah.
Yeah,
the best stories about her.
She used to take me to, go with her and Cyril from Vervolet to a few tastings, and I was therefore invited into post-tasting inner sanctums, like sub-chalk basements in Champagne, and like amazing.
Oh, really?
Revelry, like,
because she's old school aristocracy kind of stuff.
That's what was kind of fun about it, like, yeah. The sort of like the contrast.
High low,
high low.
Because I heard some crazy stories about her. Like one time, this guy was like, "You have to." What was it like? Oh, it was something like he was parked in her way, and she's like, "You need to move your car," and he was like, "No." And she's like, "No, you really need to move your car." And he was like, "No, old lady, get out of my way," because she's an older, small lady or whatever.
Wait.
So she took her wine key and like went after his tires, like slashed the tires with her wine key.
Uh huh. Wait. No, I mean, are we talking about the same person?
Clozel.
How old is she?
Oh, I don't know. The old lady. Like, she's 45 or something.
Maybe more.
Maybe more, yeah.
I mean, my friend is younger.
Oh, okay.
She's probably, she's getting up.
Domaine de Clozel.
Domaine de Clozel. Not the winemaker, the daughter.
Oh, the daughter. Oh, you hang with the younger set.
Well, I mean.
Sorry, I missed that.
No, I see the other one. The one to whom you are referring.
At tastings and stuff?
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah,
and
whatever,
I say, hey,
dude.
How's your daughter?
Right. See, that seems perfectly reasonable to me. But no, then there was one where she was she was coming back from a party with her husband, and they'd been drinking a lot, and they decided to take two separate cars, and he was behind her in the car because they had two cars, and they both needed to go somewhere the next day or something. And obviously there's strict drinking laws in France, and she was pulled over. Mm-hmm. And so she tells the cop, "I'm so glad you're here. This man has been following me for miles in a very suspicious manner behind me." Whoa. And so the cop takes off instead of giving her a breathalyzer, because she would have gotten arrested for DUI. So then she drives off, but leaving her husband taking the bag. You know what I mean? Can you believe that?
Wow. I wonder if it resulted in any difficulty for him besides saying, "No, she's my wife."
Yeah, I don't
she's
know.
Gone.
I didn't hear the corollary to the story, but that's the story I heard.
There is a sort of a craftiness, a wicked craftiness in her daughter as well.
Is that true? Well,
I guess.
Maybe we won't go too far then. It's probably already enough lawsuits
probably,
coming from
right?
this one. Yeah.
Ish.
yeah.
So, I don't know, yeah.
So you're tasting with the aristocrats in the subterranean cellars?
I suppose so, yeah. And you know, it becomes very, like that party movie with, the Pink Panther guy.
Sure.
Did you ever see that?
I saw several Pink Panther movies because my dad was a big fan, and this is true. I would come home from school sometimes, and he'd be like, "Aya!" Like when I opened the door, like
Kato?
His assistant would always attack him when he came home, and he would pretend to do that, and he would like pretend to that he was going to attack me. This is true.
That runs in my father's side of the family as well.
Just in lunatic humor.
Well, yeah, and
yeah,
Peter Sellers.
Yeah, Peter Sellers was huge for my dad.
Kato. All that whole dynamic, I think that's also universal.
Do you think so? Because I never hear anyone talk about it anymore. I don't know.
What?
No, Peter Sellers or Pink
Panther.
Oh,
no, I mean like the sort of the sidekick.
Oh, the sidekick guy.
You know,
yeah, sure.
I kind of want to...
Like Batman and Robin or...
Yeah,
the Green...
Don Quixote and Sancho Panza.
Sure. That probably gets a big start from that. You know
right?
what I mean?
Yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I sort of feel like that would be a really good sort of group of screenplays, like secondary characters. That sort of thing.
Well, yeah, it was like you could do like six secondary characters in search of an author or something like that.
Yeah, or like a movie about Robin instead of Batman.
Right.
Or
well, Kato. They do those.
I know sometimes, right? And
yeah.
I kind of am always interested.
Yeah. It was like, well, remember when they did Beowulf and then the guy did Grendel years later? It's like from the other side.
I didn't see Grendel. I want to see Grendel.
I'm actually not a bad monster. I'm just trying to make my life here, and you're attacking me with a sword.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
I'm hunting
that kind
of
stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
Did you ever see that Twilight Zone where, like, the whole time you're with this lady who's trying to kill these little things that are running around her house? She's terrified of them, and they're harassing her, and she is trying to club them and stuff like that and kill them. And then the little guys are. They take off in a NASA space shuttle, and it was the whole time you thought you were sympathizing with the lady who was trying to kill the little aliens, but it turns out
they were us.
They were us, and she was. It was like a land of giants. And so at the end, as the spaceship, as these guys are escaping and the spaceship takes off, you realize that that's us, and our perspective of sympathy had been with the wrong side.
Yeah, Gulliver kind of thing.
Yeah, very Gulliver. It was just like that. It was an early TV show when it was black and white.
I know. I saw so many of them. Don't remember that one, though.
So you come back to the United States.
Come back, yeah.
To make some dough, because you're out of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a friend who was the F&B person for the Maritime Hotel, those guys, now worked for Andre Balas. And
Oh, okay.
So he called me to come help him get the standard going.
Sure, the original one, because there's two now.
Yeah, I barely even knew that. And so it was before they had a restaurant, there was just a bar. So we were just I had to make, I don't know, 15 different possible wine lists to satisfy all their powerful investors, and one with 20 wines.
You had to make 500 possibles?
Wine. Dude, it was insane. And I was in Paris, like, sweating. All I needed to buy, like, because you don't just, like, make a list of wines you dig. Like, you have to, like, make sure they're available.
Right.
And if you put them on the list, they're going to show up.
And what price would that be and all that
stuff.
It's
insane. Yeah. You know, so it was a lot of work. And so
the vintage is still correct. And, like, hasn't changed. Yeah, I mean, you know what I mean? The realities of it.
It's not like, you know, what we do is hard.
It's not an Amazon wish list. You know what I mean?
So anyway, so then I was still hoping. He was like, I'm not sure how it's going to work out. Maybe you can go back and forth. Not sure what role we want you to play.
That's always good when someone says to you that they're not sure what role they want you to play. Right. That's always.
But for now, yes, you can go back and forth. They even sent me to, Chateau Marmont to check out that situation.
Oh, sure. And, well, that's pretty. You're chilling by the pool with all the movie stars?
I just showed up one night, and it was almost empty.
You're like, put me in Belushi's room.
If only. Just to see if what I thought about the wine list, and I don't know. So, But then, I don't know how long it was, a month or 2 months or something. Apparently some investor couldn't Google me. I know, that's sort of what my friend said. So that was out. Well,
then you had a name.
I didn't have a big enough name.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, Il Buco.
Yeah.
For something like that.
You weren't on LinkedIn, so they were like, you're out of here.
But I have, I think it's the only time I've ever been fired, but it's the,
dude, my name is fucking Bill. There's 10,000 Bills. That's why I chose Levy. Because I was like, you Google that shit, it's coming right up. Pages and pages of results.
There's also, the thing is, if you Google Bill Fitch, you get the basketball coach for like 200 pages.
Right. Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. That's what you're fighting against. So you're effed.
Oh, no.
You know what I mean?
But they fired a lot of people. But yeah. The next person they hired was Andrew Bell. Well, gone soon. I think someone from Per Se fired. Like, I don't know what, you know. So I don't feel so bad.
Right. Well, I'm not. We're still friends. You know what I mean?
Eric Ripierre, I think. Ripierre was fired from their Miami thing. You know, like, duh. Like, why would you do that? I don't know. And
this guy doesn't know anything about fish. I'm trying to open up a restaurant in Miami. It does fish.
So, whatever. They have their own reasons and modus operandi. So then my little brother's girlfriend told me about her friend who was opening Vinegar Hill House.
Oh, okay.
So we met.
Seems like there's a lot of ex-girlfriends and girlfriends involved in your job process.
I don't know. Is that not normal?
You're like, screw Google. I got my own social network.
Well, it was my boyfriend, my little brother's girlfriend, so. Yes.
I like how you kept it in the family. It's like Wuthering Heights. It's like the next generation. You know what I mean?
That's awesome.
Still fighting the fight.
But me and Gene Adamson, my boss, and I met at Katz's Delicatessen. We hit it off.
Nice.
Boom.
Didn't have to eat for another day.
Didn't what?
After you ate there, you didn't have to eat for another day because you were completely full.
Week. And she let me keep going back and forth. I said, that's Yeah, we made a deal, and that deal is still in place.
And how long has it been at the Vinegar Hill?
It's been open for about 4.5 years, but they didn't get their. I started in February when they got their liquor license.
February?
No, 4 years ago, February.
Okay.
4 years and whatever, a couple months.
And how? I mean, what's changed over the course of the time it's been open?
More wines. The clientele's a little different. And I think we've gone through a similar process of, you know, new hipster places opening and then finding their.
Seems like some have tanked or had to change concept.
Yeah, and who knows? I mean, we haven't hit the 5-year mark, which I guess is the magic mark. Like after you get 5 years, maybe you can say, okay, we were kind of a success. But
do you feel like you've changed the neighborhood a little bit?
I guess. It's not, I mean, many neighbors love us. There is the problem that it's hard to, of like car services coming and honking. But otherwise, no. I mean, the neighborhood is just that one block. It's just us and now Hillside on the corner.
Which is your other place.
Yeah. And so, of course, it's changed.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I hear.
You're not taking credit for it, is what you're saying. You're like.
Oh, hell no. No.
Yeah. Because you don't even live there. So you're like.
Yeah, I don't live there.
Nothing to do with
that. I spend
a
lot of time there. I know that. There are people there that have been there for a long time that don't like the new, you know, what's
new
happening.
Newfangled kids.
Just one block.
Coming in. Yeah.
And then some people that really are desperate for us to be there. So
yeah.
I don't know. It's New York. It happens.
Not everyone's going to be happy. Usually.
I understand the urge to be a hermit and to disappear and not to have any. I would love to, you know, because it is kind of like, for me, like Portland or like a little urban oasis. I'm sorry, a rural oasis. That's nice.
That's what Vinegar Hill's like?
Kind of, yeah. You know, just those few blocks. Sweet. There's like different birds there. There's like giant furry caterpillars. Like there's, I don't know, there's some kind, it's a different ecosystem. I mean, I wouldn't.
And speaking of that, how did you design the wine list for that different ecosystem?
Well, I mean, it started in, you know, when the crisis, the Great Recession was, more, I don't know, people were more conscious about it. And so it was designed to be cheap and it's sort of continued in that vein. Although for me, now we have a few wines above $100, but the markups are quite low. And it's nice. We do a lot of volume for such a that size place. And I've also been, you know, I don't get to taste a lot of things that I used to taste a lot because I have to taste so many cheaper wines, you know, like basically wholesale. I mean, can I even talk about this? I don't know. Gauche.
It seems like the natural wine thing is in keeping with wines under $100 usually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, although they're creeping up like everything else,
right.
Like friggin' Cru Beaujolais or
right, $80 on the list and stuff.
Angry,
yeah, it's crazy actually. But
I mean,
you know, it's in
they're great. It's like right. Great. That's good for them. But on the other hand, it's been so nice to have them so low for so long.
Right.
So yeah, it's basically just a constant. It's grown a lot, you know, and as we've grown, so there's what I don't know. 110 wines, something like that. Not a ton, not even that much, really. But yeah, it's just, I'm just trying to find, you know, a variety, and I want to like maybe I'll have two Burgundies, maybe two of one appellation, but I like to have as much variety as possible, and not to repeat styles too much. Although I tend to always to have a lot of Grenache blends, you know, Grenache Mourvèdre, Sancerre, Grenache Carignan, whatever.
Well, those are cheap now.
They're cheap.
And they're accessible.
And they're kind of good for our food. And so, yeah, I mean.
You find the customer response, people dig it?
People seem to dig it. I've been very lucky. I mean, it's funny how it's changed since 2004 when I was, you know, back then. You had to have a Pinot Grigio, pretty much.
I know, I remember.
You had to have an Australian Shiraz.
Yeah.
So when I did the list, I had Alkumi, Australian Shiraz.
Yeah.
Boom, nothing.
Nothing would happen with it.
I didn't have Pinot Grigio, but like Chardonnay wouldn't sell. I can barely sell Chardonnay now. Some people for the consistent but rare customer that asks for an oaky Chardonnay, I mean, maybe this is just Brooklyn. We say that sometimes distinct, you know, you can actually taste the oak, but pretty much Chardonnay, even like Macon, like all kinds of inexpensive Chardonnay, I've tried a lot. Some move, but not a lot. People want a geeky experience, I guess. Although we don't sell mostly geeky wines, if whatever that means. I mean,
do you feel like you're required to have things like we used to be required to have things? Because I remember that era. Like, right? Boy, I have to have this. So now is it like I have to have a sherry and an orange wine or what?
I think those pressures are real, and you know, you got to make money for your restaurant. So
right.
If I think that's one. Yeah, I think those pressures are real, and you have to respond to them. I mean, it's what makes sense to respond to them, depending on the place. I mean, like, I know Fifi, for example, at Ten Bells is like, fuck Sauvignon Blanc. No, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I like Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
I don't even Merlot. I like Shiraz.
Yeah.
There's so many good ones. Like, I think it's, but Sauvignon Blanc does take away often from other sales. Like, it'll just, if I have a Sancerre on the list, boom, like, other things diminish. So
yeah, I know exactly what you mean by that.
Yeah,
I've watched it happen. I mean, you have 10 wines that you really believe in, you put one Sancerre there, and you watch those other 10 wines like sell half as much or a third as much.
Yeah, so it's fun to, but I feel lucky that we have the both interested servers and staff that are jazzed by cool wines, or you know, adventurous whatever wines, and also clientele that asks for them. Like,
yeah.
I feel like, and also changes. Like when I first put a couple orange wines on a couple years ago, I don't remember, which the, like a Bea, Arboreus or whatever.
Which is a good one.
It's expensive for
it's
us.
It's expensive, yeah.
And a couple others that I had, they were just, no.
Oh, really? No movement?
Almost none. A little bit, but.
Not enough hype on the orange wines, huh?
And for me, that's a kind of problem at that time, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, I think that's true, actually. But so because there's not a lot of room on the list, you know, I'm looking for
things that are going
to move a little.
Yeah,
I'll try there. Something else.
Right.
And then, in fact, they didn't move. So when we opened Hillside, I just put them on there. And boom. They moved.
Really?
Everybody wants one. Like I have to have one by the glass even.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that from somebody else. The guy who works at Hotel DeMano is like, if I put anything skin macerated for under $20 a glass by the glass, it immediately moves.
On the other hand, if I put it, once it starts to get warm, if I put a chilled red on, even if it's not like a Gamay or a light something, or like boom.
Boom, right?
Like, why? I don't know. Like, people think it's... I don't know. I mean, not that I don't like a good, a nice.
Well, in a way, that's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Skin macerated white that's served cold and
right.
Chilled but, red. Maybe that's the move. Anything chilled.
And it's also sort of a little different. That's the move.
You know.
So I don't know. But it's always entertaining to sort of.
You're watch saying when you have your own personal thing and you're not too affected by it, you can kind of look around. Like you have a taste and you know what you enjoy. And you're not so affected by trend. You're kind of amused by trends. Is that what you're really saying?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It can be amusing. Like when you couldn't sell Merlot after Sideways.
Right.
Like, I mean, okay, there's a lot of lame Merlot, but it's not a horrible grape. I mean, people enjoyed it before. You know, those sorts of things are... But I think those are... it's fascinating how that sort of subjective element affects... not just the commercial wine world or whatever, but how we imagine what we're drinking. You know, like it's so much imagination. Like,
do You think it's the same with perfume? Like, totally. Seriously.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, with the marketing of perfume and,
yeah,
you know what I mean, affecting the perception in the market.
And that's partly because we don't know so much about olfaction, and we're all... When I was into perfume, there's this place in Portland called the Perfume House, run by this awesome and creepy Adams family-like family. And the guy would... The father would say, close your eyes, and like spray a little cloud of perfume and say, advance through the cloud. And like, I loved that. I was so into that.
I do that with Sherry sometimes. Oh. Sherry mist.
Advance through the Oloroso.
I could do that.
Or the Criadero.
Well, that's good. I can see you doing that in your dress or whatever.
Right.
The Emperor's New Clothes.
Well, that's a whole effect.
Oh, my God, that's so hilarious. I don't know. So, yeah, for me, that's the fun part. I mean, I loathe, like, the Robert Parker.
So, are you saying it was a blind tasting of perfume? Is that what you're saying? Like, you didn't know what it was, and you would walk through it, and then you would...
He would do that sometimes, especially because he knew he had my number. Like, I could... I'd max out credit cards, not knowing
how I would.
You know what I mean? But this place was amazing because at the turn of the century, before communism in Russia, some of the greatest perfumers were Russians, and there was a Russian community about 20 miles outside of Portland, maybe even less, and they would go there all the time because this guy had a museum of perfumes, and he knew the history of perfumery. He was a nose, and he worked in, I guess, Germany or something as a nose for a while. And these like, seriously, babushkas, like, they were, you know,
with the hat and stuff.
Culturally, like, dressed traditionally, kind of, would come in and, like, fill this space, and he would, like, tell them all about these perfumers, and they remember, like, their grandparents telling them about these great perfumers, and he would do the same with them, and they'd cry and get all emotional, and I think that's really kind of amazing. But
I mean, the same thing can happen with food. Like, if my wife makes a hamburger, like my dad used to make a hamburger, just by through random chance, or happens to make spaghetti that way, or a salad that way,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, because there's a million iterations of how that dish could be done,
mm-hmm.
but one day it hits the table and it's that way that you grew up with.
Wow.
That can be, it's not just a normal meal all of a sudden.
It's Proust. It's Proust.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it's very,
It's just, it's what is it called? Something memory.
The Madeleine thing? Or?
Yeah, but the memory is, I can't remember.
Retronasal.
I was going to say that too, but it's like that.
It brings it back.
Brings it back to
Bill Fitch. We're going to bring it back to Bill Fitch. We're going to bring it back to what's next for you? What are you going to do next?
Oh, I'm going to Georgia.
You are?
Yeah.
Georgia? Well, which Georgia are we talking about?
The wine producing nation.
Okay. See, because I screwed that up.
Well, I mean, that's kind of fine.
When are you going?
For a week, June 5th to the 12th.
And what's the scenario?
The scenario is it's the Quivery, whatever, symposium, and there's going to be a bunch of tasting that, you know, they're trying to
get they did all, last year, yeah.
To get us all into the
orange stuff,
Don't
call it M4 though.
Yeah, don't call it M4, jazz. So I was going to go horseback riding with this guy John from Pheasant's Tears.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure.
And I still intend to, because he offered. And like, he was like, 2 months. You can, we'll ride over the spine of the Caucasus and dip down into the valleys and then back up, like, and just like.
No way.
Way.
It's like Dr. Zhivago with horses instead of trains.
So awesome.
What?
So I'm like, I'm there. Like, yeah. When? And he was like, June. And so I was scheming. Wasn't looking like I was going to be able to go this June, maybe later. But, and then they just said, come for free for a week. But I'm a little bit frightened, frankly. Because I have experience with Slavic men, older Slavic men. and
Ish. You have experience ish with.
Exactly. Yeah. And they, and even in Paris, I went to this Georgian tasting because Thierry Puzelat is now importing into France. All the Georgian wines, or many of them. And there's all these, like, grim-looking dudes. This is my wine. And, you know, I would spit, and they'd be like, no spit. Right. Drink. And I'm like, I'll tell you a funny story about that.
Vodopivic went up there to learn about winemaking in Georgia because he wanted to do clay macerated stuff in Italy, in Carso. And he, so there's many facets of this story, but one is that there's no handbook in Italy in any library that tells you how to make wines like this, and there's very few people you can talk to. So he's like, I'm going to go to Georgia. And he also lives near the border. So he hires a translator. He goes, and he does like internships at different wineries there. And he said that the hardest part was just keeping up with the drinking.
Yeah.
Because he said that the average consumption there is it's roughly 2 to 3 bottles a person per day. And he said that the drinking games would get really intense. And every time they cheersed, you were expected to drink your thing all the way down to the bottom. Yeah. And they cheersed a lot. And the whole thing was just being able to handle it and still wake up and do stuff. Like, that was the most challenging part. It wasn't like, oh, the special kind of clay or, you know, pushing it down to the thing or anything. The hardest part was going and holding up with the drinking.
There's no way. I'm epileptic, so I have to be like, no way. And I don't know if they'll understand. Maybe they'll think I'm, you know, pussying out or something.
Well, I think that has... that is something that comes up with a lot of epileptics over time in different situations. Like that people don't understand why. You know what I mean? And then there's a weird thing, and then they cast them out as witches or something. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah,
it's been a problem in history.
It's a very interesting history. I don't think that's still the case in Georgia. Maybe.
Well, hard to say. I mean, I haven't been. I haven't read through the caucuses and the spines.
Maybe there are pockets where they're still. Expose their epileptic babies, and you know.
Well, I mean, I was watching the Grosvenor video on YouTube. You know, it's in two parts. You know, where he goes to Georgia, and it's not super high tech. You know what I mean? Like little babies running around with no clothes on, stuff like that. It's pretty, you know. But that was a couple years ago. So
it's always been my, like, before I die, I would like to ride my bike around the Black Sea, and so I'm that's my secret mission is to. See how if that's possible there.
Did you tell the guy from Peasant Steers this?
Yeah, that's.
I'm sorry, I always call it Peasant Steers.
Oh, that's. I wouldn't have noticed even.
Yeah, sorry, it's Peasant Steers. Yeah. Sorry, it's not. Yeah.
Yeah, I told him that, and then he was like, "Dude, come."
Well, Bill Fitch, you're a good guy, and I'm glad you're on the show today.
You're very kind,
Bill Fitch of Vinegar Hill House and Hillside. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, our little here bonds fist or when you want to do a beer deal. Not a person, not what needs of today. Rock, Linkstrom. Wine Blown Sipcom.
Thanks. All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.